Welcome to the Zeitgeist 19 curated podcast, exploring the spirit of now through the lens of art and sustainability. Your hosts are Farah Pirie and Elizabeth Zhivkova.
We are delighted and privileged to kick off our new podcast season during United Nations Climate Conference COP29 with an insightful conversation with our co-host, Jan Pachner, Secretary General of the One Ocean Foundation. Jan firmly makes a call to action for an adequate response to the threats that have arisen at this decisive turn in history before it is too late. The fellow ocean defender speaks about our magic blue pearl that we have to care for and protect, the one-time chance we have in accelerating ocean solutions and re-establishing peace and harmony with nature. Jan introduces the opportunities in the blue economy and natural capital, trying to make new waves clearing the way to a more responsible future, meanwhile guiding us to what's coming next in this podcast season. Hi Jan, we are grateful to have you on board and launch this exciting collaboration with One Ocean Foundation today here at COP29. We are here to talk about the ocean. Why ocean? What is it so important about it?
Hi, Elizabeth and Farah. Let me start with a big thank you for offering One Ocean the opportunity to collaborate and for having me as co-host of this season's podcast series. So the question is, why ocean? Well, when we go up in space in the search for some kind of possible form of life, what's the most element that we're looking for on all these planets? When you listen to these astronauts that went out there into this dark space and they look back, they all describe our planet as this magic blue pearl. So even if we call this planet Earth, the principal element that all life depends on, and we should always remember this in one form or the other, is water. So this takes us back to the ocean. Our planet is covered by more than 70% of ocean. 97% of the planet's surface water is found in the ocean. And just to keep going with some numbers, the ocean with its microorganisms, the phytoplankton, produces 50% of the oxygen. The ocean is home to 90% of the world's biodiversity. 3.5 billion people depend on ocean for the primary source of food, and this is likely to double over the next decades. Since centuries, the ocean has represented for mankind a sheer unlimited space, source of inspiration to explorers, and representing an infinite resource from which to draw freely. If you remember back, it was the Club of Rome in the early 70s. With a report that stated that we just can't keep going and taking resources as if they would be unlimited. And it's still, I think by today, we still didn't learn this question. So it's taking us quite some time to really think about the meaning of that. And it's just now talking about climate change that I think this discussion has really started to sink in. And so when we talk about climate change, what would you define as the most important global issue for the survival of humanity for the future? I think this is it, right? And the ocean is our biggest ally in climate change. We can't seriously talk about climate change, discussing about greenhouse gas, not considering the ocean. It has absorbed so far about 90% of the excess heat that has been produced by humanity. And this is equivalent, now hold on, this number is pretty mind-boggling. It's equivalent to 134 million atomic bombs that every year have been trapped by the ocean. That's the amount of energy that is produced by this heat. But it's not gone. I mean, it just it's stored in the ocean, and that's what triggers these extreme heat waves, and the weather patterns of ocean and atmosphere that are created by creating our climate. And so the ocean that has basically with its living organisms absorbed about 30 to 40% of the excess CO2 that has been produced by human activity so far. Unfortunately, all these things come with a cost. And so it's important to understand that the ocean is like a huge giant that is moving slowly. And it's absorbing all this energy. And it's thanks to the ocean that our temperature hasn't increased much further than what we feel right now. And so we're just starting to feel, unfortunately, these issues of climate change and ocean warming. You know, it's a main driver for sea level rise and the loss of habitat and death of marine species. And when we talk about ocean warming and the increase of sea levels, I think what many people not consider is that just basic physics, when you have a liquid, what's the liquid behavior when you expose it to more heat? It expands. And so it's not only the ice that is melting on our poles, it's also the expansion of the liquid itself, of the water itself, of the ocean, that actually causes, I think, up to 1/3 of the sea level rise. And so this added to ocean acidification. Acidification, it changes basically the pH level of the water, because when you absorb by the surface waters that are absorbing the CO2, what happens is it changes the pH level. So the water becomes more acid, and it makes it tough habitat for small species that depend on carbonate structures like coral. Unsustainable fishing is another huge issue and pressure point for our oceans. Our fish stocks are completely out of balance. That's probably thanks to the new technologies that have been deployed, just trying to maximize the catch, but it doesn't give nature enough time to get back in balance. And we're just taking too much. We're just taking too much and too quick. And so we really need desperately what the United Nations have been asking for is 30% of our ocean as protected area. Now, the original target to have this by 2030, but I think that's pretty unrealistic. So let's shoot for 2040. But I mean, this is really a must target, because this 30% of really protected ocean, meaning that there's no fishing in that space, this should provide us enough resources for the future to have enough fish. And so I think it's just a smart way to go forward and to do this. Eutrophication. We're talking about wrong agriculture, or you know, we have been using and overusing fertilizers to completely unbalance nature, and the results are runoffs with excessive loads of nutrients. They grow algae and unfortunately cause oxygen depletion, and so in some areas we can see that basically you have in these surface waters, you just have a lot of fish dying and species dying because there's lack of oxygen. So contamination, pollution, oil spills, marine litter, plastic pollution, alien species. I don't want to keep going on because otherwise this gets depressive. But there is a lot of pressures out there. And the sooner we realize that we are really playing with the devil here, we have to change the system, and we have to be aware of what's happening, because only when you're really aware, then you can do something about it. As long as you're ignorant, and I think today, probably in time and age of internet, ignorance is a choice. And I don't think we can afford it. Definitely not when we think about trying to create the future for our next generations. And we have to realize that all is connected. And that's why I also like really the name of this podcast, Above and Below. It's we have to realize that the famous butterfly effect, you know, let's add that we still have we're still at the very beginning to understand really what's happening below the surface of the sea, because science tells us that we rarely know maybe 15% of the ocean ecosystem. And so currently there's actually a race going on to get as much data as soon as and quickly as possible. The United Nations have declared 2020-2030 as the ocean decade. And so rightly so, because we know, it's crazy if you think about it, we know much more detail on the map of the moon, on the surface of the moon, than we know on the of our seafloor. I mean, we have only mapped maybe about 20% of our seafloor. So how can we know more on other planets than what we know of our own planet? It's just something that it's, for me, it's a bit crazy. Spending billions to try to go to other planets and, you know, let's first try to really know our own. And so there's still so much lack of knowledge of species that we don't even know. We don't even have time to get to know species, and by the time they're already extinct. So it's a bit sad. And we really have to go back where I started. If the human race wants to survive on this planet, we really need a healthy ocean. Actually, in this lifetime, we really have an amazing opportunity as well. I mean, obviously, it's important to know about the different issues and the pressures that we're facing. But it's the opportunity that I see is really that it's the first time that we really know all these things, and we can really do something about it. In the past, we weren't really aware of what was happening, and so now we can see the effects, and it's a amazing opportunity we have at this lifetime to really get a grasp and make that change that is needed. And so that's probably a once in a lifetime opportunity that we are having. So let's use it.
Thank you for sharing about the crucial role of the ocean, Jan. Can you tell us how One Ocean is trying to address some of these urgent issues? And can you give some examples for some regenerative practices?
Well, with One Ocean, we concentrate our efforts on mainly three areas of activities: blue economy, ocean literacy, and environmental projects. So let me start maybe with blue economy. That is probably one of our biggest, our most important columns. Since the beginning, really, that's where I think One Ocean Foundation is. We try to differentiate ourselves because simply we realize that 80% of the environmental pressures on the ocean environment are caused by industry and industrial activities. If we really want to have an impact, that's where I think we have to. That's really where I have to concentrate on, trying to make industry realize, make them aware of their impact and how they can mitigate these pressures. So this is one of our focus areas, and we've been studying together with our partners, CSIC, Bocconi University and McKinsey, different reports that are all published on our website. And one of them is Business for Ocean Sustainability, that basically was presented also to the UN. And from there, we have developed the Ocean Disclosure Initiative, that is the first global data disclosure framework that we will launch in the market by this year, by June. So it's an exciting year for us. And we really hope that this has an impact, because the industry has direct and indirect impacts on the ocean environment. And we really think that we have to go upstream and go to the root cause of many of these issues that we're facing in the ocean. So That's why we really want to work with industry. Ocean literacy is the second pillar. Now, when we talk about ocean literacy, we really, the focus here is to make people understand, we talk in schools, universities, trying to educate about the importance of the ocean, make people understand the influences of our daily lives that we have on the ocean and the ocean has on us. Getting facts across, like I said from the beginning, to realize the importance of the ocean. 50% of the oxygen we breathe comes from the ocean. And, when you get these facts across, then you really capture attention. And, hopefully you get also people interested to dive a little bit underneath the surface, because we are just land animals. And I think it's really important that we realize that there is the majority of life happens, of biodiversity is under the water. And so that's where all life comes from. So we really want to get more people interested in this environment. I mean, 70% of our planet is ocean. So let's conquer the wisdom of this area and get also the science, drive data and try to understand how all these things are connected. And I think the more we realize how interconnected everything is in nature, probably that's also a way to re-find our space in nature, to reconnect with nature, because I think over the past 50 years or maybe even more, we completely lost that. We somehow feel we're outside of nature. We can command, we can dictate, and that's not how it's happening. We are part of nature, and if we don't realize that, we'll be out of nature pretty soon, because we'll be gone. So I think we have this one time opportunity to where we realize how interconnected everything is, and we really can do something about it. Before, probably we didn't know. The generations before us, they were not aware. They didn't have the data. Now we know. We know what we have to do. I think we have the solutions. It's just a means of getting them done. And one of them, the first one we really have to get across, is how to protect nature and protect that little nature that has still survived so far. And then start to restore slowly, or rather quickly, hopefully, what has been lost. And so that's where our environmental projects kick in, when we concentrate on blue forest, like reforestation projects of Posidonia Oceanica. Posidonia is it's an amazing plant that only exists in the Mediterranean. And it has capabilities of absorbing CO2 that are really unique. It's a champion. I mean, if you compare it, 1 acre of a Posidonia meadow can absorb the equivalent of CO2 like 10 acres of Amazon rainforest. I think these numbers are really amazing. And this is part of these little facts that, I think we have to educate people and make them aware of all the treasures that are actually sitting down there. And these are really assets. I mean, also talking about coastal waters, Posidonia only reaches a depth of maximum 40 meters. And so we really find it in coastal waters that should really be super protected against all the different threats that could be anchor chains and anchors from boaters that don't realize where they drop their anchor on. Another area another project that we're focusing on is the Canyon of Cabrera. It's an underwater canyon that reaches a depth of about 1,000 meters, just 20 miles north of Sardinia, of the island of Cabrera. And we've been analyzing over the past 5 years environmental DNA, underwater acoustics, sites, trying just to gain scientific data on the richness of biodiversity in this particular area, especially on sea mammals. We've found 7 out of the 8 species of sea mammals in the Mediterranean. And this area up to now is still not protected, but we managed to gain quite some visibility, also because we have managed to get the area qualified as a hope spot by Mission Blue of Sylvie Earle. And this is just on our way to hopefully get a marine protected area status for this area, because it really needs protection. And then we have dune projects to protect the coastlines. And so I think there's amazing opportunities out there when you look at these environmental projects, because you see how quick nature actually recuperates if you give it a chance. And so this is one of these one of the nice areas concentrating on this, gaining data. We have also another project, it's called Mare. We do it together with Chiwochi, which is a sailing association in Cabrera, a very, very important sailing school. And we're using a catamaran over the past 3 years as a scientific platform to gain, to basically make a mapping of the Mediterranean on, again, on environmental DNA, alien species. We did ecotoxology examples, also on plankton samples. And so trying to get a lot of data, because the Mediterranean in itself is a hotspot on climate change. Unfortunately, the Mediterranean Sea is heating. I think we're having 2 degree higher by average increase in temperature on seawater in the Mediterranean than on the other oceans. And so because it's a closed sea, it also is more affected on pollution and high traffic, marine traffic, on transportation, but also on tourism pressure. It's a huge density of population that lives along the coastline. And so I think the Mediterranean Sea is actually very exposed, has a huge amount of biodiversity. Although it's such a small sea, it has a really big and very rich amount of biodiversity. So I think that's why we're concentrating also on a lot on our projects, environmental projects on the Mediterranean. I think we can see overall that there is amazing opportunities out there when you talk about these kind of projects, also growing seaweed, for example, in the future. When you talk about regenerative practices, there's this book out there that I really recommend to everybody. It's The Seaweed Revolution by Vincent Domoseil. To me, it was kind of an eye-opener on not only the story, the history of seaweed, going back to the Neanderthals, and how important the diet was at that time to make our brain grow with omega-3 containing a seaweed. It's really a superfood. And I recommend it to everybody. It's one of these revolutions, I think, that are taking place. And on a global scale, I think we see at the moment a 35% increase on the seaweed industry. And it's one of these positive stories that I'd like to share, because you can, it's one of these examples where you can actually make money and have a positive impact on nature as well. So it's a beautiful story, and it should give a lot of hope.
Thank you, Jan. I remember when Elizabeth first introduced us in Milan, you mentioned natural capital, and it really caught my attention. Could you start by explaining to our audience what natural capital is, and maybe share a few words on how it could be recognized as a new asset class?
Well, Farah, thanks for this question. Natural capital can be referred to as any value that comes from nature, like soil, air, water, probably came to a specific space. So to give it a better example, in our system, in our value system, unfortunately, we're giving value to dead nature. When you go to the market, you know, you buy dead fish, or you take furniture, which is basically it's a dead tree. When you buy the wood, right? Vegetables, meat. And when we talk about natural capital, actually, I'd like to give value to living nature. So let's take, for example, Ralph Chami. He's a pretty famous economist, worked for the IMF, and he gave this definition of a living whale. I'm not sure if you heard about it, but I think it's spot on. Basically, if you take a whale, and you buy it at the fish market, the value is $50,000 approximately, right? You take the same whale and you take the value of the whale, the services that the whale does free of charge, like the carbon it absorbs, and throughout his lifetime, let's take an average of 30 years. And you put that on just in the carbon market, the amount of CO2 it sequesters, plus being buoyant negative. So when the whale dies, it goes down basically into the depths. And usually from a scientific perspective, we say that reaching about 1,000 meters of depth under the ocean, that's when you basically have a pretty stable and safe carbon storage for the at least 300 years. So if you take that calculation just on the carbon current carbon market, the value of this whale with his services goes up to 2 million. So why on earth would you kill a whale from an economic perspective, right? And the same equation could be done for mangroves, or it could be done on other examples. I think they did the calculation also on elephants in the savannah, linked to carbon sequestration. So this is just to say that I think we have a huge opportunity here. On one hand, it's a tricky question, because can you really give value to nature? Right, it's a bit of a. If you talk to indigenous people, they would get really upset, right? Because how can you give value to air or things like this? So already, basically, we're driven by the, you know. Everything is driven basically by money. But since, unfortunately, this is the way our system works, we think actually that there is an opportunity, and it could be a very big opportunity of basically trying to rebalance a bit the global south that, unfortunately, like Africa, has a lot of development countries, and are one of the few places that really we still have today a lot of that natural capital, like mangrove areas or salt marshes or savannas, like just wildlife. And where in Europe, this is gone. North America, basically, it's almost gone because there's some natural parks. And so we desperately need to protect these last pieces of wilderness. And this could actually drive, if we give value to this natural capital, it could actually drive money to these poor countries and provide them with the necessary resources to protect this, to really make that national parks and provide jobs, provide security, provide income, and actually start to restore, you know, and add on more of these areas and just make them go wild again. That's what we really need. And so this could really drive funds, money, where I believe it's needed the most, on regenerating, and actually to third world countries that really need it. And we need it as well. It's one world. So versus these areas, unfortunately, have been lost and are gone in many parts of our industrialized world. We're still lucky to have them in the underdeveloped areas. So I think we have a huge opportunity at our hand that has to be used wisely. And I fully understand the arguments of indigenous people. I've been talking with them about it, but since our system, unfortunately, that's the way it works, money makes the world go round. I don't think we're going to be able to change that rather soon. So I think there is an opportunity that we have, and we should use that. So this is about natural capital. I hope I got that answer right.
Let's talk about the blue economy, something we hear a lot when discussing the ocean. What's your definition of the blue economy? And in your view, how can it drive both sustainability and innovation in ocean conservation?
With the term blue economy, we refer to the concept of ocean economy. So the economy that is basically directly linked to the ocean environment. But we significantly expand it by taking in consideration all economic activities that either directly or indirectly generate pressures on the marine ecosystems and actively contribute to preventing and mitigate these. So we said already the ocean economy is economy that has a direct link to the ocean environment, like shipping, maritime industry, fishing, ports, etc. We expand that concept when we talk about blue economy. I mean, most of the definitions, when you hear blue economy, they just speak straight about ocean economy. But we try to expand that definition. And I tell you why. I give an example of the textile industry. Textile industry is really the second most polluting industry, unfortunately, because of microplastics. And we all have an impact on that. We all have, washing machines. And unfortunately, there is no filters today, I think, that really capture all these different microfibers. When we talk about textile industry, the impact it has on the ocean environment through these microplastics is indirect, right? But if I find a company that realizes and actually is realize that impact of the industry and is willing to actively mitigate the pressures that they're having on the ocean environment, for example, by using different fibers or different dyeing, so they don't use that much water. I mean, there's a lot of technology innovations that you can apply now, also in the textile industry. So it qualifies for me as a blue economy, because it does something actively to mitigate these pressures. And so it's almost like a quality seal, if you want to say, to be part of the blue economy, because it means for me that you're realizing that you're having an impact on the ocean environment, and you're actively doing something to lower these pressures. And that's our definition on the blue economy, and we hope that we can get that message across, especially with new ocean impact assessment tool that we're trying to present, which is the Ocean Disclosure Initiative. And that should really give a tool to the different industries to realize where they have these pressures and give them examples on how to mitigate them. So when we talk about blue economy, I think it's a huge opportunity window. especially when we talk about future innovations that are coming up with this new technologies that just provide us with different solutions that were not available so far, or we have not really concentrated our efforts on it. Let's talk about offshore wind wind farms on alternative energy sources, or when we look at alternatives to our traditional way of agriculture. We look at seaweed, aquaculture, but done in a very sustainable way. I think there's huge opportunities out there, especially for countries that have a lot of coastline. Italy, as an example, you know, we have about 8,000 kilometers of coastline. And with the territorial waters, these are areas that have really big potential for future innovative industries. And I think we will see a lot of new things happening over the next 10 years in that space, from biotechnology, using of AI. There have been inventions now on creating a Wi-Fi network underwater, basically connecting different devices. So I think there's really a lot happening out there, and which is also great news, I think, for the ocean itself, because it drives, I think, all this lack of data, of scientific knowledge that we're facing so far. And I think technology can definitely be of great help in that. So I think it's exciting times, and we're at a perfect spot to really realize what's happening, and we just have to use whatever is in our hands now to sort of drive that change. And and I think there's examples out there where we can really have a positive impact.
Thank you for this positive outlook to it, Jan. We can all agree that the challenges we are facing today require cross-disciplinary solutions. At the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned the ocean as a source of inspiration. And lately, we've been collaborating together on a few cultural projects. Why involving the art and the cultural scene in the scientific narrative is crucial?
Elizabeth, I think when we take climate change as an example, how much time has passed that we've been talking about it and nothing really happened, or you know, people didn't really. I mean, there's still doubters out there neglecting climate change as a fact. And what this discussion has been going on for the past at least 30 years, I would say. So we probably didn't really do a good job on trying to get that message across. And I think we just don't have that luxury anymore. Also, especially when we talk about ocean, it's all linked and interconnected. Maybe the ocean in some ways is easier to communicate because people associate with it, because everybody, you know, on at least on vacation, you maybe go to the ocean, you go to the sea, you go on the beach. There's many jobs linked to the ocean directly, fishing, you know, we said it before. So maybe there is an easier concept to talk about ocean. But I think art has always been a means of communication, and artists many times have been trying to get messages across that were provocative, and they were maybe ahead of their times, actually. And maybe during their lifetimes, they were not really understood. But afterwards, you know, now they're celebrated. And so I think art is one of these really important ways of getting communication across, where maybe sometimes scientific arguments have difficulty to be understood. And so I think we really have to use art as means of communication. We have to use all means of communication that we can really use. And my hope is that art can, you know, we see it also, we've been using art. As example, I mean, we've been using art or forms of art also on with the ocean. We did the ocean cinema in Milan. We were exposed. We did some short documentary films, and we're now planning to do another documentary film on seaweed. So I think there are different expressions of art, and can be photography, can be live performance, can be music. So I think there's many ways, and it's important to touch these strings of communication, because I think they're part of our soul and who we are as human beings. So I think anything that can help to get these messages across is absolutely valid. When we did our exhibitions also on live performances, to trying to get something emotional, to get emotional messages through. The ocean is about emotion as well. And I think it's a great way of combining scientific messages together with what drives our inner emotions as human beings. And we are part of nature. And I think this is the most important message that we have to get across, and trying to find that balance again, trying to get back into nature and to find our balance back into nature. And this is the one-time opportunity that humanity has. And this doesn't come from me, but I like it a lot because it made me think. And I'm happy to repeat that phrase is, we're probably the first generation that cannot say that we didn't know. But we are going to be the last generation that can really do something about it. And so I think art can help us in getting that message across.
Thank you, Jan. Your answer to Elizabeth's last question actually reminded me of something Dr. Helen Chersky, who will be featured in our current season, which is very exciting, said in her incredible book Blue Machine. She mentions that art and science are more interconnected than we often realize. And I completely agree with that statement and with what you highlighted about communication. It feels like the perfect note to end on. Once again, thank you so much, Jan, for this insightful conversation. We are incredibly excited about this collaboration and the journey ahead, bridging art and science with One Ocean Foundation and so many inspiring voices still to join us.
Thank you very much from my side as well, and to both of you. Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope that we get it was good enough to get the curiosity for people to deep dive a bit and get curious on the next sessions that we will have, and try to introduce some new concepts and give hope. Should end with a positive feeling. Thank you.